Burgers, fries, and a soda did not become a ubiquitous roadside meal because of the McDonald's brothers. Though they may have invented the concept, it was Ray Kroc who took a single business, McDonald's, and turned it into an international franchise. If you are an avid listener of NPR, you probably hear Kroc every day. NPR was just one of the many recipients of the Ray Kroc money, much of which was given away by his third wife, Joan. Author Lisa Napoli's recent book is a biography of the Krocs. It's called Ray and Joan, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away. I spoke with Lisa about the couple, beginning with why she wanted to write this book.
Well, you know, part of it is because I worked in public radio. I heard Joan Kroc's name every single day, so you couldn't help but be curious. But the real motivation was a sculpture of a nuclear mushroom cloud, a sort of cartoon-like nuclear mushroom cloud, if you can imagine it, that I went to cover as a story for public radio. And it was in disrepair. It wasn't clear what was going to happen to it. And one of the activists who was standing by fighting to make sure it still stood whispered in my ear that Joan Kroc had paid for this sculpture years before. And it made me very curious. Why? Because she didn't live anywhere near Los Angeles where I was working, and it just didn't make any sense. So that got me curious. I looked for a biography and I couldn't find one. So I decided I had to write one.
I could see where a woman whose fortune was based on her husband amassing this McDonald's empire and who was notoriously conservative himself, it must have really astonished you to see that she would be connected with not only a peace cause, but something as radical as this piece of sculpture.
Yes, Lois, and that's exactly what was so fascinating to me, because at that moment, standing underneath this sculpture, it clicked into place for me. I thought, you know, we know that she supported public radio, but it didn't ever kind of come into focus for me to ask, who was this woman? And that sculpture is what sort of sealed the deal for me and made me go on this quest. I just, you know, I'm not a McDonald's fan, and McDonald's didn't help me with this book in any way officially. There were people who were involved with McDonald's years and years ago who were very generous with their time. But I don't eat at McDonald's. You know, I decry fast food, and it just didn't line up. How could this woman be a peace activist with this family history? And I didn't realize at the time either that she was Ray's third wife, that she was considerably younger than he was. And it's one of those fabulous acts of discovery that we all have in our lives every day when things start clicking into place. And the more I found out about her, the more I just couldn't wait to learn more about her and try to make it all line up.
You say that giving had been Joan's greatest gift to herself. Would you explain that?
You know, I think that anybody who hears this, who knows the joy of giving, and we all give in different ways to our families, to our children, to our elders. Some people give money, give time, volunteering. Anybody who does any of those things knows, as arduous as it sometimes can be, it's usually extremely gratifying. And even though Joan had the means and did indulge in fabulous riches, fabulous jewels. She had this private plane. She kept upgrading it. She lived this larger-than-life, opulent lifestyle. She also was so incredibly giving, and that gift of being able to give on such a grand scale, living on a grand scale, but giving on a grand scale, fortified her. It was infectious. And anybody who does it on any scale knows that it's infectious. Helping someone makes you want to help more. And certainly that was the case with her, except it was just exponentially larger than most of us ever are able to do from a financial standpoint. So that's what I meant by that.
Well, though your book seems to be a biography of Joan, it's impossible to exclude Ray, and in fact, he has top billing in the title. He was a temperamental man who drank too much, and he was obsessed with expanding his business. That obsession destroyed his first marriage. But Joan's marriage was stable when she and Ray first met. Would you tell us a bit about Ray's background?
Yeah, you know, you make such an excellent point. It became impossible for me to think so much about Joan without thinking about Ray and the source of the fortune she inherited. So while I wanted to focus on her, I realized I couldn't just focus on her. And he is not nearly as fascinating as she is, I don't believe. But women usually are so much more interesting and layered and nuanced and textured. But Ray was sort of a classic traveling salesman. He was very passionate, though, about what he was selling, whatever it was that he was selling. And he was very passionate about the food business, which is what drew him to the McDonald brothers in the first place. He had started as a piano player early on in his life and made his way into the more practical world of being a salesman and was good at it. He sold paper cups at first, back when paper cups were an incredible technology that allowed for the prevention of disease. That's what happened when paper cups first came about. And from there, he met some gentlemen in the Midwest, which is where he was raised, outside of Chicago. And these gentlemen were creating this fabulous milkshake machine mixer that was multi-spindled. And Ray fell in love with that. He had this eye for modern convenience, modern technologies, if you will, things that we take for granted right now. And it was this multi-spindled milkshake machine mixer that really excited him. And he got the rights to sell it around the country. And this was at a time in our country when the roads were developing, suburbs were developing, people were falling in love with their cars. They had more leisure time. They were, you know, driving around the back roads and they needed something to eat and drink. And so these multi-spindled milkshake machine mixers enabled mom and pop stands making hot dogs or just convenience foods, as they were known then, more possible, more portable. And he just saw this all line up and saw the future in this one machine until he found the McDonald brothers. And that sort of crystallized everything he'd seen in his work up until then.
Before you tell us about the McDonald brothers, one thing I found fascinating was your mention of the relationship between Prohibition and the American consumption of sweets.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? Yes, I loved this. Was such a fun exercise in researching this book because there's so much about the early and mid 20th century that I knew vaguely about. Of course, I knew about Prohibition, but it didn't occur to me that with the prohibition of alcohol, that meant that people had to get their excitement elsewhere, and that excitement equaled sugar. And so as a consequence, ice cream was a wonderful treat that sated people's need for you know, it's not sinful, of course, but it was something that replaced people's habits. And there was a huge consumption of ice cream, which is why ice cream parlors and milkshakes in particular were so de rigueur. And Ray seized that moment with the milkshake machine mixers, as did the men who invented it. So yeah, that was a fun tidbit.
So these social forces at mid-20th century that you mention and that contributed to the rise of McDonald's includes the idea that for middle Americans or people on more modest incomes, dining outside the home, eating meals outside of the home became socially acceptable and maybe felt like a sign of affluence for them.
Yes, yes. And that's why, especially here in Southern California, which was, you know, aided and abetted immensely by the development of the suburbs, but everywhere in the United States, of course, that was true. Families would hop in the car and go for a ride and they'd need something to eat or to cool off. And it is an incredible part of the middle class that's easy for us to take so for granted for now. But driving Southern California, as I do now promoting this book, I go from place to place and I think, you know, there used to be orange groves here not very long ago, and now they're replaced by fast food stands. And it wasn't McDonald's quote unquote fault because there were many other players at that moment in time. It's just that McDonald's had the formula and the success, the way Google became the search engine for so many people and outpaced other competitors who came to the game earlier. McDonald's just outpaced its rivals for a variety of reasons. But yes, it was a perfect storm. It is a perfect storm, actually, that conspired to make all of that happen.
So to understand Ray's vision, which included all of these social forces and the advent of the interstate, we need to know about those McDonald brothers. Who were they?
Yes, they were the real visionaries, the early visionaries, in the sense that they had come out here to Southern California from New Hampshire, and they needed to make a buck during the Depression. They were having a hard time, as so many people were, and they saw that an orange juice stand was seizing early motorist traffic, and they started one themselves and expanded and added barbecue, which was arduous to make, time-consuming, expensive. And then they just decided one day they were going to pare back what they offered their customers and just go for what people were most interested in: hot hamburgers, French fries, milkshakes, Cokes, coffee. And they came up with the most efficient system they possibly could. People may remember that there was a time when we had car hops who waited on the cars, who drove into drive-ins. It was, you know, kind of exotic, but those were really pesky nuisances for employers because there were all kinds of shenanigans that happened in the parking lots with the women who were who comprised most of the car hop workforce. And the McDonald brothers just got rid of the car hops. They got rid of the glassware, the plates. It was too expensive to employ the dishwashers. There was breakage, and they just went as efficient as they could. And so they really drew out a factory line, an assembly line in their store, which they reconfigured. Of course, ironically, they used mostly local ingredients for their food. So their food was much better quality than we know it is today. It was all locally sourced hamburger buns from a local bakery, et cetera, et cetera. French fries that they cured in a pen out behind the store. Yeah, it's an incredible thing to think about how simple that seems, but how marvelous a technology that was at that time. And others came to look and see what it was that these guys were doing that was creating so many long lines, and they got written up in trade magazines because there were other people who were doing well with selling hamburgers and convenience foods through car hops, but the brothers were far and away much more advanced and efficient and serving their customers.
In the 50s and 60s, what appealed to the public about a recognizable brand?
That's an interesting thing, too, now that we're all in the back to local movement. What was appealing about it was that was a symbol for people that they were going to get something good and consistent. Whereas now, many of us like to try something from a local restaurateur or find food that was grown or produced locally. Then there was something very exciting about the idea of knowing it was going to be consistent. And that wasn't, as our country grew and as we became more mobile, that became a mark of security and comfort to go to a new town, a new place I hadn't been before, and to see that something was available that I'd been able to get back home. So that gave way to this chain movement that, of course, dominates, you know, the landscape of our country and the world right now. And in its earliest days, it was a very quaint idea.
It was surprising to learn that Ray Kroc didn't earn as much as his franchisees. until 1960. What changed?
Well, you know, he knew going in when he convinced the McDonald brothers to let him franchise, and they were reluctant. They didn't want the work or the hassle, but Ray wanted to do it, so he did. He gave them a percentage of the royalty that they took from franchisees. 1.9% is what a franchisee gave back to the corporation, and 0.5% went to the brothers for their idea. And the 1.4% that Ray collected was put in coffers to help the business grow. And like most new startup businesses, business people will tell you that you have to keep plowing the profits back in and continuing to expand. And so it wasn't until the business had grown to the point where his chief associate, Harry Sonneborn, was able to borrow more money from banks to continue this expansion that he was even able to take a salary. And it wasn't until they bought the brothers out in 1961 that that entire royalty went into the coffers of the McDonald's Corporation.
Ray divorced his wife, and Joan left her husband to marry Ray. But then what happened?
Well, she got skittish. She had a young child. She'd helped her husband with his build his own mini McDonald's empire. He was a manager in a store, and then he became a franchisee. And it's never been entirely clear why she returned to her husband, but she did in 1961. And then it wasn't until 1969 and another marriage for Ray that they finally did unite.
What ultimately reunited them?
It was McDonald's, of course. It was a McDonald's operators convention in California. Ironic, since it wasn't far from where Ray and Joan ultimately made their home. But Ray had been asked to appear at an operators convention there, and Joan saw that he was on the bill speaking, and she signed her and her husband, who was this franchisee in Rapid City, South Dakota by that point, up to go. And off they went, and it was the piano that had united them in the first place, where they had met over the piano when Joan was playing at the Criterion Restaurant in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it was the piano again that reunited them at this event. Ray invited her and Raleigh, her husband, and others to get together, and she and Ray played over piano and rekindled their romance and decided then and there to run off with each other once and for all.
How did she adapt to her role as Ray's wife?
You know, it was hard for her at first. She wasn't a great, as you would call today, disparagingly, a trophy wife. She was 26 years younger than Ray and was expected to just go out and shop and spa and maybe sit on a board of a charity. And that was not interesting for Joan. Joan was much more ambitious than that. She was much more energetic than that. And so she tried her hand at that for a while. And ultimately, dealing with Ray's drinking weighed on her so much that she realized Ray had started a foundation after he became enormously wealthy in 1965, and she decided to get a piece of that and put it to work for her efforts, which were called Operation Cork, Croc spelled backwards. It was all about helping people in the 70s understand the impact of drinking on not just the person who drank, but on the entire family. So she coalesced a number of people in the burgeoning movement of addiction treatment in the 70s that was occurring, and financed many, many people's work, research, and was a pioneer in that sense because of her efforts.
The combating alcoholism was her first foray into philanthropy. And some of the things you bring out in the book reveal that this was not a dilettante dabbling for a cause or, you know, organizing some grand social event to benefit a cause. She actually looked into the curricula of medical schools and, you know, wondered if doctors are trained in how to address alcoholism with patients. This was only the 1970s. It wasn't all that long ago.
Yes, and it's hard to imagine, but that was the case. The doctors were given something like a day of training about addiction issues. It wasn't a specialty necessarily, except for people who'd taken that on as their life's work. And so Joan was outraged to learn that and got connected to Dartmouth Medical School, which was wooing Ray for a slice of his philanthropic money. And she instead wooed the medical school into working with her to or into creating, taking some of the money from Operation Cork and creating a program to teach young doctors about addiction. Really, really progressive and really, really forward thinking. A really interesting way of addressing the problem. She saw that Ray had not been called out by his doctors for his drinking and was really concerned about that. So she worked with doctors who taught doctors how to fix that. So I find that fascinating about her, too. There'd be nothing wrong if she'd just written a big check to somebody who was doing some work. But she wanted to be, as you say, much more hands-on than that.
1984 was the year Ray died, and it also seems a rebirth of Joan, or maybe the birth of Joan. One of the things that you mention very soon after writing about Ray's death was Joan's interest in news.
Yes.
What else?
Yes.
What else did she take on?
Well, what an incredible year 1984 was for her. He passed early in the year. The San Diego Padres, which she inherited and was very reluctant about it because she wasn't a baseball fan, started winning and went all the way to the World Series. She had made a movie. She'd financed a movie starring Jack Lemmon, who she'd happened to meet randomly, and she decided to underwrite the film Mass Appeal. She was powering down her Operation Cork work and just starting to give with abandon to different causes that she cared about by writing checks. The zoo was a big beneficiary, the San Diego Zoo, as was the peace movement. She became very intrigued with the peace movement because of her friendship with Norman Cousins. Really, you know, there's this movie coming out about the early days of McDonald's. I wish someone would make 1984 in Joan Crock's life a movie, because she flourished. She came alive in a way that she hadn't before, being left to steward this money. There was a tragic incident that happened at a McDonald's months after Ray died, a terrible incident. A person walked in and killed many people at a McDonald's not far from Joan Crock's house. And Joan, instead of just sort of recessing into the background and letting the McDonald's corporate people take charge, stood up and plunked down $100,000, which was quite a lot of money at that time, to start a victims fund for the people who were affected. So she just really rose to the occasions that were presented to her, the happy ones in the Padres and the really tragically terrible ones in this mass murder, and came alive. Yes.
She knew from empathy.
She did. She was really, in many ways, the embodiment of it.
Well, all of this for us, Lisa, is the crescendo to the Crock gift to NPR, of course. And that had loads of surprises as well in your book. But again, it shows this aspect of this dynamic aspect of her personality. I mean, I had just assumed that she woke to Morning Edition and, you know, her day revolved around All Things Considered and this was the reason. But she confused NPR and PBS initially, you wrote.
Yeah, and she was just a media junkie. She loved news. She had it on all the time. She liked and enjoyed listening to different opinions, even if she didn't agree with them. And she was not your classic NPR person who can recite the name of every single person on the air who they hear every day. She just, you know, people who are hearing this, who work in development and know what it's like to court people who have means of any amount, know that really what it comes down to when people give is whether they like a person. You know, I'm not going to give money to an organization if I don't like the person affiliated with it or running it. And that's what it was for Joan. She believed in the mission of NPR. She loved Kevin Close, and she wanted to see it flourish. And she had this little pot of money, not so little for most of us, that she needed to divest herself of at the time of her death. And NPR was the extremely fortunate recipient of it.
What do you want people to know when they hear her name on the daily underwriting credits? What would be your wish?
You know, that's a great question. I think I have a couple of wishes. Wish one is that people will hear that and be motivated to give. Both Joan and Ray didn't want to leave all their money behind. They just wanted to make sure that people had access to it and could do good things with it. And, you know, Ray gave that money in large part to Joan, knowing that she was going to give it away. And that's what she did. And I hope that people, when they hear her name, think about this person and maybe take some time to find out more about this person who came from very modest means and who understood the power of giving. It's something that's really easy to forget in our daily lives. And cynics may say that, you know, Joan had a lot of money, so of course she gave it away easily. But a lot of wealthy people don't give away money, and a lot of wealthy people don't have the compassionate heart that she did. And now is a really important time for all of us to put our actions and our money where our hearts and minds are. And she did that. She led the way. And I just hope when you hear her name every day that you'll think a little bit about this person who's much more than just a name you hear recited. There's much more dimension. There was struggle, suffering, and just a kind, kind heart.
Ray and Joan, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away. Lisa Napoli, you have written a very engaging book that has many lessons for us. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm thrilled and flattered that you think so and that you've taken the time to talk with me so thoughtfully. Thank you so much.